You're listening to Conversations on Strategy. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the podcast guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I have Dr. R. Evan Ellis in the studio with me today to discuss the conflict in the Middle East and its impact on the Western Hemisphere. Ellis is a research professor of Latin American Studies at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. His research focuses on the region's relationship with China and other non-Western Hemisphere actors, as well as transnational organized crime and populism in the region. Welcome to Conversations on Strategy, Dr. Ellis.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
How do you perceive the current state of the Middle East conflict, and what factors do you believe contribute to its complexity?
It is in a delicate situation right now, and certainly the Biden administration is trying to manage the risks associated with that by proceeding cautiously and interacting with all of the different actors and stakeholders. But really, the complexity has to do with the fact that you have multiple interconnected actors and multiple interconnected, long, intractable conflicts. You also have competing interests and many actors who are using surrogates, such as Iran, working through not only the groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah, but also the Houthis and others. The difficulty of controlling those actors, given that their actions have escalatory effects. One of the other problems is that so many of these issues involve actors' core interests in which the sides involved, especially Israel and their neighbors, cannot, for both political and security reasons, compromise well. But without reaching those compromises, the conflict itself goes on. Certainly, the way that the campaign is conducted has created a lot of significant issues with a number of casualties, and the way in which that has isolated Israel and put certainly the United States as its security and political partner in a difficult situation. Beyond the conflict in Gaza itself, there are a number of overlapping issues. Certainly, you have the ever-present risk of escalation by Hezbollah in Lebanon. Ironically, there are disincentives for both sides to escalate. On the one hand, while Hezbollah certainly would like to be seen politically as playing a role in support of Hamas, it also understands that in the pluralistic environment in Lebanon, that if it were seen as essentially bringing a Gaza-like disaster on the Lebanese population, that would be politically very bad as well as organizationally very bad for it. At the same time, also Israel recognizes that it has a much more capable foe in broadening the war to face Hezbollah, in that Hezbollah has an estimated at least 130,000 rockets, many with longer range, and forces which are seen as a bit more capable and better trained than the Hamas forces that they're facing in Gaza. You have a very delicate situation there. Of course, the biggest, perhaps, geopolitical surprise has been another Iranian-backed surrogate group, the Houthis in Yemen, again, with their multiple attacks on U.S. forces, actually spotlighting a difficult U.S. situation, given that U.S. operational activities in places like Iraq are associated with a bit of tension with surrounding governments who both want to see us there. And yet, it's a bit awkward to have that close relationship perceived with the U.S. What you also see with the Houthis is the way in which, by effectively shutting down the Red Sea and having an impact on global maritime transit, which affects international logistics prices, which affects petroleum prices and other things, and creates escalatory risks there. And then, of course, at the end of the day, you also have the ever consistent danger of escalation between the U.S. and Iran more directly, given that these are effectively its surrogates. And even Iran continuing to push the envelope with respect to, for example, attacks on supposedly Israeli targets in places like the interior of Pakistan and, I believe, even Tajikistan. Strategically, again, at the end of the day, the difficulty wherever this campaign goes, whether limited to Gaza or not, is the difficulty in finding an exit strategy. Difficulties in the long-term two-state solution for Israel as well as for others. Very difficult for the Palestinians after such massive destruction to essentially live with Israel under similar conditions. Very difficult for any future government, even post-Netanyahu, post-Likud, to live with a Palestinian government that was not perceived as having been completely de-radicalized, given that this is only the worst what happened with the slaughter of more than 1,200 residents of Israel. But at the same time, also understanding that accepting something that was short of guaranteeing Israeli security would politically not be acceptable for the long run. The exit strategy of this is unclear, and yet at the same time, the escalatory risks continue to expand.
How does the Middle East conflict influence geopolitical dynamics in the Western Hemisphere?
It's an important question, Stephanie, and it reminds us that Latin America is ever more internationally connected, both in economic and secondarily geopolitical terms. So first of all, there are about six different ways, and we can talk about each in more detail. But first, there has been a notable increase in support, which was always there, but a little bit suppressed with respect to the Palestinian cause in the region. Number two, there are a variety of different diplomatic effects that involve anti-U.S. populist regimes and their outreach to organizations such as Hezbollah and such as Iran. At the same time, other diplomatic initiatives by parties that we'd consider opportunistic, such as Brazil in the region, and others, frankly, such as some of Israel's strongest friends in the region, such as Argentina. In addition to that, you have potential economic effects that have to do with increases in oil and logistics prices, as we talked about before, and how that ripples through a relatively fragile Latin American economies. You have potential effects with respect to the increased activity of Hezbollah, which has both functioning as a financing organization as well as some potential as a terrorist organization embedded in various different countries in the region. And at the end of the day, you also have channels for Iranian re-engagement in the region, especially working through anti-U.S. populist regimes such as Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, and others.
Tell me about the economic repercussions in the Western Hemisphere that are resulting from this conflict.
The biggest potential impacts come from the impact in global commodity prices through those logistics effects that we alluded to before. And so at one level already, those ships no longer being able to transit through the Red Sea and transit through that region, those longer transits and the increase in insurance premiums of having to use those waterways push up logistics prices globally, which impacts the price of a number of different products, as well as creating some supply disruptions for specific Latin American consumers and suppliers. In addition, if you have an escalation of the conflict, which pushes up international oil prices, something that has not yet happened, but it's never present risk, although there are some countries in the region, such as Venezuela, as an oil producer, albeit with limited capacity to produce, that would benefit. Some countries that would benefit partially, such as Brazil or Ecuador, but many countries, especially those who do not have oil, such as the majority of the Caribbean states, etc., that would be prejudiced, and you would see a lot of social difficulties as prices for things like home heating oil and cooking oil, as well as transportation fuels, hit some of the most vulnerable in those politically challenged countries in different ways. In addition to that, there's always the prospect that if you do have a larger escalation, especially in the Middle East, that has secondary effects, for example, on an already stressed economy in China, or helps to precipitate a financial crisis, not unlike what we saw in 2008. Those type of effects could also have repercussions on commodity prices for Latin America exports, as well as its economies and access to finance in general. Finally, economically, if we do see the possibility of terrorist attacks in the region, especially with relatively pro-Israel countries such as Argentina or relatively pro-U.S. countries where you have substantial Lebanese populations such as Ecuador, for example, or Paraguay, those type of things would have economic effects in those countries themselves and confidence in their financial systems.
How do you see the Middle East conflict influencing diplomatic relations between countries in the Western Hemisphere and those in the Middle East?
First of all, the diplomatic relations with most of the countries in the Middle East and Latin America has been relatively limited. There have been a few exceptions in recent years. We've seen outreach by some of the anti-U.S. populist states, such as Venezuela and secondarily Nicaragua and Bolivia and Cuba, among others. We can expect to probably see opportunities for those countries who have already really doubled down on criticizing Israel's actions and reaching out to support their engagements with actors such as Iran to continue in that path. There are also, however, certain other states in the region in the Caribbean that have traditionally had small but important Muslim populations. Here I would talk about Trinidad and Tobago, as well as Guyana and Suriname. You can see some prospects of continuing interest and involvement of those countries at a diplomatic level. In addition to that, you have a broader number of countries that regard themselves as interested in broader global issues, especially I would call out here Brazil and the new leftist government, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who, again, whether it was involving Brazil in diplomacy over China-Taiwan or Russia's invasion of Ukraine, these are issues where Brazil sees an opportunity to involve his government in those activities in the name of Brazil's international position and reputation. So I think we can expect to see that. Difficult to say whether we can see more direct Brazil-Iran diplomacy, such as when the Iranian warship Makran was allowed to actually visit, put into Rio de Janeiro Harbor, but I think we can certainly see Brazil looking to play some role. In addition, there are prospects that some of the other Middle Eastern players that we usually think less of, such as the Erdogan regime in Turkey or possibly even the government of Saudi Arabia, could reach out to also extend ties or try to strengthen relationships with Venezuela. On the one hand, their interest in building alliances across the Atlantic take them there. On the other hand, given how much things escalate in the Middle East, those regimes will be very busy with a number of other issues, and that may restrain them to some degree.
Are there security concerns or implications for Western countries due to the Middle East conflict? How do these manifest in terms of national security policies?
It's principally about the terrorism and terrorist groups. As I mentioned before, on the one hand, you have long had various different groups, especially Hezbollah, Iran's surrogate, operating to raise funds through both criminal and illicit activities. And I think certainly with the added impulse of perceived suffering, not only in Gaza, but in other places like Lebanon, you can see some of the populations in the region, such as the 7 million people of Lebanese descent that live in Brazil or those who live elsewhere in the region, increasing remittances in a legitimate way, but in the process, a greater tendency for activity also of terrorist groups like Hezbollah, possibly to expand their fundraising in Latin America and in other activities. At the extreme, there's then the question of whether those groups also will expand back into terrorism in the region. That certainly is an ongoing possibility. We can remember that 1992 and 1994, Hezbollah actually attacked important Jewish targets, the Israeli embassy in 92, and the Israeli community center, IMA, in 1994 in Buenos Aires. There have been also Hezbollah plots in various other times in Cerco Peru in 2014, as well as during the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in 2016 and an attempt of another terrorist act in Brazil just on the verge of the current conflict. It's not without precedent. Right now, Hezbollah has strong motivations to keep a low profile because the interest of radical Islam is actually benefiting from the sympathy of Latin Americans who tend to see groups such as the Palestinians in Gaza as the underdogs, as the persecuted. Doing terrorism in the region tends to undercut that. However, if we see an escalation of the situation in the Middle East, certainly targets such as Argentina, again, the Javier Milei regime, which is relatively pro-Israel, as well as countries that are relatively pro-U.S. with substantial populations or communities or Hezbollah cells. Here I would mention Paraguay with the triple border with the Ciudad del Este, as well as potentially Ecuador with a substantial Lebanese community in Guayaquil. Potentially become targets, given that combination of two things, for the expression of anti-U.S. or anti-Israeli or anti-Western terrorism in the region.
Global energy markets. What impact has this conflict had on energy markets?
Right now, the impacts have been indirect through the fungibility of petroleum as a commodity. Most Latin American energy is actually obtained from the Western Hemisphere itself. However, you do have potential enormous impacts, again, if the U.S.-Iran portion of the conflict escalates, especially if you have physical conflict in the Persian Gulf that shuts down that very important transit area. With that, you have the possibility of going to $150, $200 a barrel oil, which, again, would have global repercussions, including in the region. In addition to that, of course, you do have some possibilities that the escalatory impacts would be restrained if, for example, some of the other stakeholders such as China act, because China is a major importer of oil and very vulnerable to this. And China also has some economic leverage in potentially restraining Iran from escalation that could push oil prices up. It really comes from the prospect of escalation, and that will ripple through Western Hemisphere oil purchasers, as well as, ironically, benefit some Western Hemisphere oil producers who would receive more money, such as Venezuela.
In terms of public opinion, how do citizens in the Western Hemisphere perceive and understand the Middle East conflict? Are there notable differences in perspectives?
In general, there has been enormous sympathy and growing sympathy through the current conflict with the Palestinians, especially as the images of Palestinian suffering has been transmitted through media in the region, including organizations such as Al Jazeera, as well as more left-oriented organizations such as Russia Today and Tel Asur, which are widely available there. In some countries, the official position of populist, leftist, in some cases anti-U.S. regimes, such as those in Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and to a certain extent Honduras, helped to magnify those sympathies. But you also have other places where you have democratic governments with substantial Lebanese populations. You certainly see that with Gabriel Boric and the position of the Chilean government and the Chilean public, which has been very attentive given its substantial Lebanese population, as well as Brazil, something like 7 million people of Lebanese descent that living in Brazil. In addition, especially in certain parts of the Caribbean where you had flows of immigrants coming from Muslim states of Asia, so legacies today of important Muslim populations in Trinidad and Tobago, in Guyana, and Suriname, that makes what is happening in the Middle East to a certain degree personal for those. In the case of Argentina, that is a bit of an unusual case because on the one hand, although you do have a substantial population of Lebanese descent there, you also have both a large Jewish population And Argentina has suffered multiple occasions from substantial terrorist acts by Hezbollah, 1992 and 1994. That tends to lead Argentines to put a little bit more emphasis on the impact of the massacre of people in Israel on October 7th, when they also consider what is happening with respect to the civilians in Gaza. The irony is that for many years, you have had substantial Jewish populations in much of the regions. There has been close work with Israeli companies, including Israeli security firms, etc. But throughout, and especially now as this conflict plays out, the tendency in Latin America has been to identify more with the Palestinians than Israel as the underdog or victim in the region.
Do you care to discuss any humanitarian efforts or collaborations between the Western Hemisphere and the Middle East aimed at addressing concerns and the consequences of the conflict?
The reality is that much like what happened with Latin America's response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there has been relatively little at the state-to-state level with respect to Latin American governments doing things to help the populations either of Israel after the October 7th massacre, nor help those displaced or harmed in Gaza. Having said that, there was some initial actions to try to evacuate those people who were living in Israel at the time who had Latin American passports, as well as to try to get some with Latin American passports who were in Gaza out of Gaza. But in general, the vast majority of help that's come out of the region has come through private channels. And to a certain degree, you do see some of that with respect to uptick in remittances. But sadly, like what happened with the response to Ukraine, the state response by Latin America in terms of trying to actually do humanitarian aid has been, unfortunately, very limited.
Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share before we go?
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity. For me, there are two real themes that come out as you look at these impacts in the Western Hemisphere on the evolving conflict in the Middle East. Number one is the degree to which Latin America is ever more interconnected, both at the economic level as well as the political level to these events. Number two is the U.S. interconnectedness to Latin America, including in the security and economic domain. In other words, what happens in Latin America, how these political currents reverberate in Latin America, and how potential external actors like Iran with interests in doing bad things to the United States, potentially the way in which certain countries and regimes in Latin America present opportunities for those external actors to channel some of those threats to the United States through the region. It's about interconnectivity, and it's yet another reason for the United States to pay attention to the part of the world with which we are intimately connected, not only by bonds of geography, but also our prosperity through our commerce, as well as by longstanding bonds of family.
I know that people can find your work at the Strategic Studies Institute website just by searching the internet. Where else can they go?
The best place to find it is probably through my own personal website, which is revanellis, all one word, .com. There you can find all of my weekly podcasts on the John Batchelor Show, something called the New World Report, as well as all of my more recent publications. You can also reach out and register to my Substack. I have a Substack that I use to share my regular publications, and so that's another channel for getting hold of me.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, SSI Live, and A Better Peace. If you enjoyed this episode of Conversations on Strategy and would like to hear more, you can find us on any major podcast platform.